Your speaker is Claude Farr.
If you'd like to follow along, you can turn to Exodus chapter 21 through 23, and I'll be looking at several selections from those verses. If you're following the Bible reading, the weekly Bible reading program, you read these chapters this week. In fact, I guess it's this week that the challenge really starts for those of you who are planning to follow all the Bible readings, because Exodus chapter 21 through 30 is not the most interesting reading that you'll find anywhere in the Bible. More than half of it just deals with the details of the tabernacle and how it was to be built and furnished and so forth. And you had a real challenge if you read through all the details about the tabernacle. In chapters 21 through 23, there's just a variety of laws and rules that God laid down for the children of Israel. And we recognize that we're not under the law of Moses. But it's good sometimes to take a look at some of the laws that God gave His people in the Old Testament. Some of them were for the political rule. And it's not that we are expected to follow these laws, but it does help us in our thinking. When we think about the laws that should rule our country and political questions and so forth, a great deal of what we find in the Old Testament can be helpful to us. I want to just look at a few things from these chapters tonight, just to kind of note them. First, I would like to just take a look at the law concerning murder. And look at Exodus chapter 21, verses 12 through 14. He that smiteth a man so that he die shall be surely put to death. And if a man lie not in wait, but God deliver him into his hand, then I will appoint thee a place whither he shall flee. But if a man come presumptuously upon his neighbor to slay him with guile, thou shalt take him from thine altar that he may die. There's three things in these verses that I just kind of note. The first, of course, is the death penalty. He that smiteth a man that he die shall be surely put to death. And this, of course, is not the beginning of the death penalty in the Scriptures. In Genesis chapter 9 and verse 6, when Noah came out of the ark, God laid down several laws for the human race at that time. Not a part of the laws of Moses, but just laws for the human race. And one of those was that whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. And as we go, come from the book of Genesis into the law of Moses, we find a capital punishment, the death penalty, being presented in this and other passages as the proper penalty for those who would commit murder. But now that's not all that we see here. We see also in these verses that there is a clear distinction made between deliberate murder and accidental manslaughter. Carefully points out in verse 13 that if a man lie not in wait, but God delivereth him into his hand. And this is, of course, a distinction that we make in the laws of our land. And I just thought it'd be interesting to read that just to point out that this distinction between deliberately, you know, planning premeditated murder, this deliberate murder, and this slaying of someone but not really meaning to, or not actually no premeditation there, that there is that distinction. Not all the distinctions that we make in our laws today with regard to murder, but at least the basis, the fundamental basis, is laid out here in the book of Exodus. And then the third thing in this verse that I like, it's concerning, I will appoint thee a place whither he shall flee. A little bit later in the Bible, we find that in the land of Canaan, cities of refuge were set up. And I think this is just a neat system. If a person committed murder, he had to go to the city of refuge. Nobody had to chase him down and get him and bring him there. He had to go there on his own. And he would go to the city of refuge and seek refuge in that city. And the elders of the city would then hear his calls. And the avenger, the family and the friends that were going to kill him because he had killed, they would come and they would have their court right there. And it would be decided if this man deserved sanctuary so that the avenger of blood could not kill him, or if he would not have their protection and therefore could, the capital punishment, of course, would then follow. I just think it's such a neat system because he didn't have to go chasing after murder. If he didn't want to come to the city of refuge, well, he was just on his own if he could keep alive, you see, because the family could go ahead and take vengeance. And that at least, I don't know that that would work in our society, but that at least was the neat system that was set up in the Old Testament. And so I thought it'd be interesting to just kind of look at the law concerning murder there. The next passage I will look at is something we'll mention just to, which is used to consider the value of the fetus, the unborn child. And I want to read Exodus chapter 21, verse 22 through 25. If men strive and hurt a woman with child so that her fruit depart from her, and yet no mischief follow, he shall be surely punished according as the woman's husband will lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. And if any mischief follow, then shall they give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. Now, this is a passage that is used a great deal in the discussion of the abortion issue. And interesting, it's used by both sides. Both sides claim this. They just interpret it different. And both sides of the issue will interpret it their way and will say, see, this substantiates what we're trying to say about this issue. And so, I'd like to just point out, I guess, the two ways that this passage is interpreted. One way is like this, that the passage is saying that if two men are striving and there's a pregnant woman there, and she tries to intervene and she gets hurt so that she gives premature birth to her children, child or children, so that there's premature birth, but nobody's hurt. Mother and child both are okay. Then the man who is at fault, he will be fined according to the husband of the woman will determine that, but then he goes ahead and puts the judges in to make sure it's not too much of a fine, but he will be fined for that. But if either one dies or is injured in any way, either the mother or the child, then it is life for life or eye for eye. And so you can see from that the unborn child is valued just the same as the mother. And that's one way of interpreting it. And that, of course, is the way it's interpreted by those who oppose abortion. That's the way that's interpreted. But then there are others who come along with another interpretation, and they say that what this passage means is that if a pregnant woman tries to intervene when two men are fighting and she gets hurt so that she has a miscarriage, not a born child, but a miscarriage, and then there's no further harm, though, to her than that, then there will be a fine levied against the man. He'll pay the husband a certain amount of money as the judges determined. But now, if there is further harm, if the woman actually is injured, killed or injured, it'll be life for life, eye for eye, or tooth for tooth. And that's the other way it's interpreted. And if you take that interpretation, then you can say, you see, the fetus is not, the life is not valued as the life of the mother. There's a clear distinction made there. And both sides use this passage. Now, I'm not going to try to settle the passage. I don't think really you can totally settle the abortion issue on the basis of this passage. But since it was in our Bible reading for this week, I thought it'd be good just to kind of bring that passage out and show the two ways in which it is looked at. Now, what I do want to do, rather than telling you the exact meaning of the passage is, I want to make sure that when you study the passage, that you study the text for what it really says, not the way it is sometimes mistranslated. And so I want to just kind of think about what it really says. The King James Version, in verse 22, so that her fruit depart from her, and yet no mischief follow. Now that's a good translation. Not totally clear. Could be interpreted a little differently, but it is a good translation. A good translation. A correct translation. And many of the other translations that you're using will translate it in a similar way. And that's an okay translation. And you can start with that and then reason as to the meaning of the passage. But I mentioned that just to show you another translation of it. And this is from a standard translation, the New American Standard Version, which is generally considered a pretty good translation. So that she has a miscarriage, yet there is no further injury. Well, now, that's easy to understand. That's clear. But the problem is, that's bad translation. Well, maybe we shouldn't put it that way. Maybe it would be more correct to say, that's not translation at all. That's interpretation. Now, maybe that is the right interpretation. That's up for as a question. But don't read that translation and then decide on the meaning of the passage, because you're not really reading a translation. You're reading an interpretation by those who made that translation, their interpretation of it. That's not really a translation. For two reasons. One, the word miscarriage. If you translate it miscarriage, then of course there's no misunderstanding the passage. But the word in the Hebrew is not the word for miscarriage. It's the word that's used elsewhere in the Bible for birth. There is a word for miscarriage in the Bible, but it's not in this passage. And so it's really, would be really kind of way out of line to translate this miscarriage. Also, the expression, which of course further gives the idea, yet there is no further injury. There's no word for further in the text. No further injury. That has an implication that gives it certainly a clear meaning, but it's not in the text at all. And now that I've criticized the New American Standard Version of the Bible, just on this passage, not the whole thing now, of course, just on this particular verse. But then if you will look, if you have that version, if you'll look very closely, you will notice that further is in italics. And so the translator is telling you by putting it in italics that you can take that out. That's not really in the original. It don't belong there. They just think that's the meaning. But you can take that out. And also, if you will look in the footnote of that particular translation, you will find that instead of has a miscarriage, that would be her children came out. And so if you use the footnote and take out the italics and use the New American Standard, you have it reading, so that her children came out and yet there was no injury. Which, of course, is the same as the King James is saying, except it's even clearer, because it doesn't just say her fruit, it says children, giving it a very definite meaning. So I just wanted to call your attention to this passage, because it's used in the abortion issue discussion, and you need to be aware of at least what's in the text, what is a correct way for the text to be rendered, and then, of course, you can look at it and interpret it for yourself. Next, I wanted to look at laws just want to kind of mention this, the liability laws in these chapters. Won't read it all, but a sample or two. Chapter 21, verse 28 and 29. If an ox gored a man or a woman, that they die, then the ox shall be surely stoned, and his flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall be quit. And if the ox were wrought to push with his horns in times past, and it hath been testified to his owner, and he hath not kept him in, but that he had killed a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and his owner also shall be put to death. And then another example of that, verse 33 and 34. If a man shall open a pit, or if a man shall dig a pit and not cover it, and an ox or an ass fall therein, the owner of the pit shall make it good, and give money unto the owner of them, and the a dead beast shall be his. Just wanted to read a couple of those, because, you know, this is a personal responsibility or liability, which is something, the concept that we recognize very much in our society, and I just wanted to know, you know, that goes way back. Here, the owner of the pit shall make it good. If you dig a pit and another man's animal falls in it and you didn't cover that, you're liable. The idea of liability goes way back. And then particularly with regard to the owner of the ox. Of course, if the ox hurt somebody and he was not known that it was a bad ox or never done this before, then the ox is destroyed. But the responsibility of the owner, if this ox has killed somebody before, and it's been known, he's been told that, the owner has been told that, and he kills somebody, well, not only is the ox put to death, but the owner is held responsible and put to death also, indicating the responsibility and the liability that people have. I don't know, I read that, and I think about some of the things you see in the newspapers about the pit bulls and people that, you know, these are real things. And this sort of thing, these type of laws and regulations way back here. Now, this is not laws that we have to follow, but I think that we can read a lot of the laws in the Old Testament. And then as we think about political issues and the laws that we ought to have today, not church laws, civil laws, that this can kind of help us in our thinking. We know how God thought then when He gave the laws to Moses. Another thing or two I wanted to touch on just quickly, found this interested. Chapter 22, verse 18, the prohibition of witchcraft. Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. In our world in which we hear a good bit about this sort of thing, you can see that God had pretty strong views about it. Last one, verse 28, concerning respect for rulers. Thou shalt not revile the gods. Your translation may say God, which would be probably better. Jehovah is sometimes put in the plural. Elohim, Hebrew, is plural. And some, it's a little hard to know whether to translate that God or God. But I think it means God here. Thou shalt not revile God, nor curse the ruler of thy people. And that's the part I wanted to notice. And this, of course, is very much a New Testament concept. Honor the king. Pray for those that rule. And as well as being subject to the powers that be. Christian people need to be very careful. We live in a free country. And if you don't like the political system, you can vote against a man. And it's freedom of speech, and we can speak out against any political view and any person running for office that we want to. But we do have to remember that the Bible does teach a basic concept of respect. We may not agree with a man's politics. We may not like his morals. But still, we have to respect the one who is in place, who is the ruler. And that's not only here in this passage, but that's very prominent in the New Testament. The idea of having respect for the office and for the ruler, as he says here, the ruler of thy people. And then the last thing, I want to look at two or three verses on this. The last thing is the laws concerning the poor. Let me read, first of all, chapter 22, verse 25 through 27. If thou lend money to any of my people that is poor by thee, thou shalt not be with him as a usurer, neither shalt thou lay upon him usury. If thou at all take thy neighbor's raiment in pledge, thou shalt deliver it unto him, deliver that unto him by the time the sun goeth down. For that is his covering only. It is his raiment for his skin, wherein shall he sleep, and it shall come to pass when he crieth unto me that I will hear, for I am gracious. One of the things that impresses me in the Old Testament is the amount of time that is devoted to the protection of and the helping of the poor. And the other week, so ago, Lamar in his class upstairs, I was pointing out that the children of Israel, they were carried away into Babylonian captivity, and he raised the question, what was the sin? And he was emphasizing two particular things. The sin for which the God's people of the Old Testament were carried away into captivity were, we all know, idolatry. But the other one was the mistreating of the poor of the land. And you read the prophets of the Old Testament. Now, that's their message. One of the messages, one of the great messages that stands out. And right here in the law, there is protection for the poor. And what is being said here is that if you lend to the poor man, you can't charge him interest. Not only that, if you take his coat in pledge for the debt, you still got to give it back to him by the time the sun goes down. In other words, the poor people had very special protection. And I want to read some more about that from the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 15, concerning the treatment of the poor. This is also from the law. Deuteronomy 15, verse 7. If there be among you a poor man of one of thy brethren within any of thy gates in thy land, which the Lord thy God giveth thee, thou shalt not harden thine heart, nor shut thine hand from thy poor brother. Obligation to help those that are poor. Skip down to verse 10. Thou shalt surely give him, and thine heart shall not be grieved when thou givest unto him, because that for this thing the Lord thy God shall bless thee in all thy works, and in all that thou puttest thine hand to do. For the poor shall never cease out of the land. Therefore, I command thee, saying, thou shalt open thine hand wide unto thy brother, to thy poor, and to thy needy in thy land. That was God's law. You were supposed to be very free in helping the poor. I especially like this part in verse 10. Thy heart shall not be grieved when thou givest unto him. It's not enough simply to be willing to give and to help the poor, but you got to feel good about it. And, of course, the reason, as it says in the latter part of the verse, is because God's going to bless you, and so you ought to really feel good because you're going to get a blessing out of it yourself. But I think he's speaking out against this idea of helping the poor but doing it grudgingly. We should really be willing to help the poor. And of course, the group of people that are going and the whole congregation involved in the Haiti mission, that's what that's about. Of course, it's also about preaching and spreading the gospel. We try to do that too. But the helping and the assistance of the poor is in and of itself a legitimate Christian mission, found prominently presented both in the Old and in the New Testament. And here, of course, is presented in these few rules and regulations about the law. Also concerning the protection of the poor, in chapter 23, verse 6, poor. Just because a man is poor, you don't take advantage of him. And there is that protection, of course. That, of course, very frequently happens that a person does not have the resources to protect himself, and so somebody with more resources can take advantage. And here, of course, he's prohibiting that. But also, and this, of course, is something that I find very important, in chapter 23, verse 6, he says, "Neither shall thou countenance a poor man in his cause." And then we're kind of balancing this thing out. Just because a man is poor is no reason for you not to be just and mistreat the rich. If there's a rich man and there's a poor man and there's a disagreement and you're rendering judgment there, don't say to yourself, well, you know, this guy's got plenty and this guy doesn't have much. You know, the rich man's right, the poor man is wrong, but still, we'll just give it and... Very specifically, that is later in the book of Leviticus, chapter 19, it talks about not having respect of person to the poor or to the rich. In other words, judgment has to be reasonable and fair. In other words, it would be wrong to bring it to our society. It would be wrong during a lawsuit, if you happen to ever be serving on jewelry, to decide that, you know, this corporation is loaded. I mean, they're right, but they're loaded. And this poor man bringing suit, you know, he's wrong in his suit, but, you know, he's a poor man. He needs it. Oh, let's take from the rich and give. Well, that's what this passage is saying. Don't do. Neither shalt thou countenance a poor man in his cause. Just because a man is poor doesn't mean that you can treat somebody else unjustly in order to help him. And so there is this balance when we look at the poor in the laws here. Well, I just thought tonight we'd look, since that was in the Bible reading, that we'd look at some of these... various laws, and I think we can read these things and help us to, while it's not the law that we're living under, it can help us to reason and think about how the laws, civil laws in our own country, ought to be. Might be if there's a person here tonight who is not a Christian. To be a Christian, you need to believe, repent of your sins, confess your faith, and be baptized for the remission of sins.